tragic accident changed the course of his life forever. For most, it would have begun a life of discontent and wallowing around in self-misery. For Jonathan Nadeau, it kickstarted a new chapter of inspiration and appreciation. Even though he lost his sight permanently, he gained a passion to put creativity first in all areas of his life. And now, he wants to encourage you to do the same. There are times when you'll be faced with a choice. Be crushed by the weight of the situation, or use the fresh start to rebound bigger, better, and more inspired than ever before. This is Tornado, stories of those who refuse to choose defeat and instead chose to embrace the storm. Here's your host, Jonathan Nadeau.
Greetings and salutations. Thank you for joining us. Yes, I'm Jonathan Nadeau with you as always. You can't get rid of me because if you did, you wouldn't have a show. Well, honestly, you'd have a show without me because this guest is awesome and amazing. So welcome to Embrace Your Storm. Don't forget, August 27th is around the corner and this film is going to be there. And if you miss this film, you might want to, no, I don't want to say that, but you're gonna hate yourself if you do. Now, today I have on Lon, and this film, Billy Kills the Internet, is amazing, awesome, and fascinating on like multiple levels in all three of those words. So Lon, thanks for coming on, man. If you could probably see him, he shouldn't be blushing. He should be like honored by this because it's a fantastic film. Lon, thanks for coming on.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
Dude, again, Billy Kills the Internet. First of all, like you see the title, like, okay, I have to watch this. Like, you know, the email comes in, you're like, great name, right? I open it up and I read the synopsis and I was like, what? And my co-director of the film festival, I'm live with him. And I said, dude, you got to hear the synopsis. And he's like, what is it? And I read it to him. And he's like, oh my God. And so I'm not saying anything to the audience yet. And so the audience knows I'm totally blind. So my buddy watches the film. He's like laughing and I'm watching it with him, but he's describing it to me as it's happening. And he's telling me what's going on. He's like, you're not going to believe this. And he's like telling me, and I'm listening to the dialogue. So as my fans here are listening to the podcast, and Lon's hearing me describe, you know, his movie, because he knows exactly everything I'm talking about. We'll get to it soon. But Lon, how did you first get involved in filmmaking? Because I'd imagine this isn't your first film, but I'd love to see other stuff you've worked on after seeing this.
Thanks so much, man. I appreciate it. I got into film at a very early age. I had a neighbor who lived down the street who lent us his VCR. He went out of town with a milk crate full of VHS tapes. And I was way too young to have access to this, but in that crate was Sam Raimi's Evil Dead 2.
Oh my goodness.
So I'm about 7 years old. And I slip on this tape for Evil Dead 2, and I start hiding behind the couch immediately and just right. sort of like peeking up to take in the right. overwhelming ability to be terrifying. And because it's, you know, you look at it now as an adult, there's definitely a campy, over-the-top cartoonish element to Evil Dead 2. But as a sure. kid, sure. I mean, it is just a direct shot of pure terror. That film.
Well, dude, it's kind of funny. We're close in age, and I almost have the same story. I mean, my mother, bless her heart. I don't know why, but at like 5-6 years old, I mean, I'm a little bit younger than you. I'm watching Friday the 13th, part one, you know, part two. And I'm just like, yowza, you know, like 5 or 6 years old taking that stuff. And I was like, whoo, you know, like.
Yeah, we were bombarded by some pretty gnarly stuff, you know. They would play it on television and we would just see these things. And it just had a profound effect on me. The fact that media could be used in such a way to induce such a level of fear in me really changed my heart and my mind about what it was that I was put on this earth to do.
That's interesting because like you're probably looking at this TV like, wow, this box is terrifying the hell out of me. Like, you know, like yeah. what's in this, you know, like you wouldn't think that I could do that. That's a cool perspective. I never thought of looking at it that way.
Well, yeah. And right away when I could get my hands on a camera, I was fascinated by stop motion animation and just the ability to use it as a means of storytelling. And right away, my brothers and I were you know, performing in front of the camera and got excited about, you know, being able to plug in a soundtrack and, you know, all that analog era of what you had to do with, you know, RCA cables and
figuring out you're like, dude, you're like tapping into my memory. It's funny. I've had this conversation before, but like, I could see for 14 years before I got my car accident. So I have these, like, I call them my sighted memories, right? But if you picture my sighted memories as like an external hard drive, like off a computer, like, yeah, they exist, the files are there, but the computers aren't really touching those files all the time, right? Like, you don't go to those too often, but they're there if you need them. And so when I think of those sighted memories, every now and then other things kind of trigger new ones that I sort of forgot. And some of the stuff you're saying, dude, it's making me remember, like, again, I was kind of your age. And I remember my mom having, you probably had the same thing, man, like the VHS recorders where you'd put the VHS tape in the VHS like camera, you know,
yeah,
and you record straight to the VHS tape, dude. Right.
Right.
So this one time, man, what I did, I thought this was genius. It was me and a bunch of my buddies, and we were freestyling at this. It was a skate park, but there's a ton of ramps and stuff, and we were freestyling there. And I had my mom's camera, and I was like, dude, check this out. And I took my Walkman, and you remember the Walkmans back in the day with those like wicked cheesy plastic headphone things, right? And the earpieces would just pop off, right? Mm-hmm. So I popped off the earpieces right off the stupid plastic headpiece. I took the earpieces, took one to one side of the microphone, one to the other, took Scotch tape and just taped it around the earpieces of the headphones to the microphone. Dude, it sounded like I put a legit like audio track over the video, and I played like Beastie Boys' Check Your Head over the whole time while we were BMXing. And when people saw the video, they're like, how the heck did you get the audio on there? Because it sounded like it looked like an MTV video, dude. It was crazy.
At the time when doing that was really hard. Like, it was a very challenging process to manipulate media in any way if you didn't have access to like traditional filmmaking, very expensive filmmaking equipment.
Yeah, dude, you said you did stop motion. So like you were legit like cutting tape and stuff then, right?
Yeah, so right away with the cameras that were made available to us, we figured out ways that we could kind of manipulate them to do what we needed them to do. And it was, I think with those old cameras, you would start the record.
Yeah,
and then
you could kind of pause the recording and
stuff. Yeah, you could pause. Yeah. And there was this sort of this process of like, and I got amazing at in-camera editing with those Sony Handycams where it had had like a switch on the top and you could actually frame by frame move back to where your starting spot. And then before you would record, you had to get your action happening and start the process. So I got like incredibly good at editing in camera, which is totally useless and insane to think about it now.
Well, no, but think about it though. Here's one thing that's cool about it is like, you know what? You didn't let that stop you. Like, frick it, man. I'm going to freaking figure out how to do whatever I need to do with what I got. And if I got to start doing the action before it's recorded, that's what I got to do, you know?
Sure. Like, and which is like, why, you know, people of our generation can never take for granted what is available to us now with all these editing suites and what is now possible. It's just, as a filmmaker, it's incredibly exciting to just be able to do it so easily. Now, I've been working for a long time and preserving my love of the industry, my love of filmmaking. You know, it can be challenging when you 100% immerse yourself.
Dude, I hear you. Which that's going to lead me to Billy Kills the Internet in 1 second. But one thing I want to say is you saying like it's, you know, leading back to you saying like it's amazing we have like all these tools, right? Like literally right now, you could probably do a search, do it and find 5 free video editing tools right now. Like, you know what I'm saying? So so everyone listening right now literally has no excuse as to why you're not downloading something and starting something right now. Like listen to what Lon did. Like he was just saying that's pure insanity. Sure, yeah, it is. But when you have a fire for it, that's not going to stop you, and you're going to do that. But like if you don't have enough fire to download one of free 5 available things, there's something wrong with you. Like, am I wrong, Lon?
I mean, listen, my education is really all about appreciation, really, of what it took to get to where we're at now to make it so easy. So kids that are coming into it that are, you know, being born in this generation, are kind of, it's unfortunate because they will not necessarily experience that journey, that analog to digital jump, which was such an incredible leap.
Yeah.
In media technology, and to make it accessible for so many people.
Or I think too, with the tools, because we were saying, like, kind of being like, oh, imagine being born with like the internet already, right? Like, so what if you're born in this internet world, right? And in this world, it's like, I guess what do you do when you're overwhelmed, almost bombarded with like free creative tools? What do you do then?
Yeah, I think it's overwhelming is the issue. I think the kids that might have an inclination to, you know, stretch some of their creative muscles in their brain are distracted by so many other things that are very, very intelligently designed to pull them in and keep them addicted to whatever video game or whatever algorithm is out there. Mm-hmm. So I think the challenge now is simply breaking free of the matrix of it all.
Yeah. And you know what? That's why being blind pays off. And I'm being serious. I tell people, me getting in my car, so went, like, the not one of, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I'll tell you what, seeing is a privilege. It's nice. It has its niceties and whatnot. But this very thing we're talking about right here, not seeing is very nice because I'm not distracted. Trust me, I get distracted, but not like that. Not to that extent and not in that way. And I appreciate that a lot because I have seen for 14 years. And I can understand, even though I haven't experienced it, I can understand how distracting this world can be right now. And so I'm aware of the distraction I am missing, you know? And but you're right. We need to find a way for, you know, when you're being bombarded to consume, why create?
Yeah, totally. Well, it's so interesting because I'm kind of learning about your situation as you're telling me. And it's, I can see why Billy Kills the Internet would resonate with you. on a certain level.
Man.
Experience the audio of it because it's a very well mixed film as well.
No, it is. It's amazing, honestly. Like, because you're hearing someone's review from it that didn't see it, but they appreciate it from the dialogue and they knew exactly where you're coming from. And then when they and then when the visuals were explained, it made it, you know, 100 times funnier. You know?
Yeah, that's so cool. That's so cool. I love it. That's a huge compliment to my brother too, who mixed the movie. We've always worked together in that capacity. We always come as a package deal.
There you go.
If you can find a good sound mixer, man, hold on to them because
exactly. And you know what? And a sort of off topic but on topic thing. Like I'm a musician. I'm always a huge fan of like bands that have like brothers in them, you know, like or bands that are just like family members. Because I have a strong belief of this is the spirit behind Tornado. Like everyone has that, we'll just call it a spirit for the sake of terminology and vocabulary. Everyone's got that spirit in them that makes them them, right? Like there's whatever in you that makes you Lon, whatever in me that makes me Jonathan. Now, when you talk about like families, obviously you're like related and whatnot. So like when you have that certain creativity that's in Lon, if you have other siblings and parents and whatnot, that sort of creativity-ish cling is sort of similar and very interesting happens when you get two brains together that are sort of in that same wavelength. So I'm always a huge fan of like families and brothers working together because it's so fascinating to me to see like what happens because there's always a good possibility of just naturally being subconsciously on that same wavelength already.
Sure. Yeah, that's a fantastic point about Billy Kills because it's such a family film. I mean, it is very entrenched in family.
Yeah,
in terms of the people that made it.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. And like and again, I think it's so you know what? So Billy Kills the Internet. We don't want to tell him everything. I think it'd be better if maybe if you I want you to tease the audience, but don't give everything away because I'd be afraid of giving away too much, but because they need to see this film and they will. But what's your elevator pitch for Billy Kills the Internet?
Sure. Well, Billy Kills the Internet is the story of a 7-year-old boy in a spaceship. He's a commander of a spaceship with a crew of puppets and his baby sister Stella. So right off the bat, it makes no sense at all.
Right.
We're completely in the realm of absurdity. And I think that sets the tone for the rest of the film because the idea of killing the internet is absurd.
Right.
So we had to kind of embrace that in a way that was going to work for the narrative. But then what it essentially is a, it's kind of a play on the Never Ending Story. If you remember the Nothing.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
The Nothing threatened the world of Fantasia because people had stopped reading books. So we take a similar cue from that, and we have kind of a wizard from some other galaxy explain to Billy, you know, that he summoned Billy for this purpose, that there is a fungus that is destroying worlds across the cosmos. And it's this fungus that is actually the internet. It starts off as really cool. We think it's great. Everyone embraces it. But suddenly we realize we're in trouble. And this fungus consumes the planet, essentially. So he's sent on an impossible mission, which apparently others have attempted it, but have failed to destroy it once and for all. And he has to, you know, get a special power in order to do it. And he finds that in an area that has been removed from the knowledge base of what the internet represents, because that's what they all use to find things, which is it's called the Lilac Quadrant. And in the Lilac Quadrant is Vishnu, and Vishnu has been commandeered by the internet. He's got four arms that have four cell phones,
and yeah,
feet that are just running across all the, and he's just in agony.
Dude, you're explaining this way, but because I love how you gave away nothing, which is awesome, which is why I'm laughing when you're like oh yeah, and this happened, because I know what's going on.
I had so much fun visualizing, you know, these set pieces and figuring out ways to kind of you know, bring the theme into these absurd cosmic kind of, you know, scenarios. And, you know, it kind of follows a traditional narrative where, you know, the lead has to defeat, you know, kind of a mini boss at the midpoint.
And exactly. Then, you
know, take on the final. And it's very much also inspired by video games and video game aesthetic.
Absolutely. Oh, totally. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That plays a big part in terms of the third act and the third act really, really pulls people in. Like if you're not 100% on board, like, you know, kind of the halfway point, it suddenly does something to the audience. And I've noticed this during screenings where it draws you in at that last,
okay,
like 10 minutes. And people just like really get glued to it.
So I would say right there is where you need to stop, like sort of describing like the plot and the synopsis. I want to talk about, I mean, you sort of mentioned this, but like, dude, you have puppets in this, like real people doing stuff. And like, I don't know if it's claymation. You're like doing stop motion stuff. You're doing like animated. Dude, you like kind of did everything a filmmaker could do in like one film. It was like, you're just like, why not? You know, like if we're going to kill the internet, we need like every weapon, right? Like,
right. No, for sure. That's a great way to kind of describe it. It is leaning on every means of visual effects. And I'm not a crazy effects wizard. I mean, some people might say that I'm skilled in that way, but like I'm doing what I know and what I can lean on to pull it off. You know,
I'll say this. People probably hear what live people, puppets, claymation, it all works. No way. I'm telling you, you watch this thing and you'd be like, wow, okay. Like it's like, first of all, it's like, sure, I'm wordless and speechless because I'm blind and I can't explain the thing that I haven't seen. But understanding technically the mechanics behind that is inexplicable. Like, I'm a smart guy. Like, I got a computer science degree. You know, I built an operating system that was used in over 30 countries. Like, I understand a lot of stuff. I'm into crypto and all that. Like, I get a lot of stuff. I know what kind of stuff it takes to get this done. And like getting it done the way he did, it's like no joke. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, you know, people that understand the technical prowess behind it will look at it quickly and be like, oh yeah, it's cool or whatever, but it's legit, like very impressive, you know?
Thank you so much, man. That really means a lot. I mean, cinema is the art of illusion, right?
Right.
If you can figure out ways, and listen, now you can do things that are so... You can do so much more than you could ever do before, especially on the consumer level.
I know exactly.
It took me a long time to make this film. I'm not going to say it was easy. It was many, many frames, a lot of animation, But you know, what drives a filmmaker can be a strong theme. And because I really believed in the work and kind of the mission, I really got behind, you know, what we were trying to accomplish. And when it came to the third act, I there was this sense of like, oh, it's over. It's so much. It's so, you know, you can kind of feel the weight of it when you don't have a big team that is supporting you. It's just like, it's
totally
all you.
Totally.
But I kind of just picked up my, you know, my sleeves or my straps or whatever. And exactly. I just got it done. I just, every night I would hammer away, you know, if the computer crashed, fuck, I got to start over again.
Exactly. You know,
just keep at it. And there was just something driving me. And then when I delivered it to my brother to do sound, I think I sent him on a similar process where he came back to me and he was like, you know, he was exhausted, but he was right. Like, yeah, but I love it. I love it. And I have to finish, you know, cause I love this so much.
Yeah, no, exactly, like, man. Exactly.
I do too. I know what you're talking about. There's something that we have to, you know, it was like, we were on a mission to get this thing done. And
no, and it's well deserved. I mean,
thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I've been taken aback by the success of the thing. Film Freeway is another modern
wonder totally.
For filmmakers, totally. What you can totally. Do on that website. I mean, I submitted it to, first of all, I got written up on Film Threat, which was huge.
Oh, that's a great place to be written up on for sure.
So having a really positive write up there helped me. I put it into every cover letter that I sent out to every festival I submitted it to. So they all saw that there was a certain clout, you know, that the film had.
Absolutely. That's what you got to do, man.
And I've been really just sort of blown away by the reception of it worldwide. It's won over 20 awards.
Wow. Well, I mean, you're definitely going to win whatever from us. I mean, that's clear. But
well, listen, trying to get someone to actually sit down and watch a 24-minute film who is programming festivals is a challenge in and of itself. To simply pull someone through the narrative so that they do feel what I want them to feel is challenging. So I do get rejected from a lot as well. And oftentimes I feel like maybe they just didn't really watch it. You know, they didn't.
Yeah. You know what, dude, honestly, my opinion, I might be like an outlier film festival. I don't have much, I'm not in the film industry. Right. So I'm very different when it comes to that sense. Like I co-ran a festival for 4 years, but this is the first year I'm doing it. I'm not new to doing events. I've helped high-end technology events at Harvard University, you know, a bunch of other stuff. So putting on events is nothing new, but the way the film industry kind of treats you as a submitter is quite disturbing, in my opinion. You know, everyone has kind of their niche or what they're trying to do. I mean, if you read my festival, it's like, hey, look, you got this thing that was this fire burning inside you enough to the point where you made this film, enough to the point where, you know, you're going to pay money to like watch, you're going to pay money for people to watch your film and hopefully they'll show it to someone else. Right. Like,
right.
So you came to that extent. Let me help you find people, watch your movie. Like, because I'm a creator. I get it. I'm a technology guy and I'm a creator. And so I know how to kind of bring marry technology in with the creativity world. And so that's how I'm coming at the film festival is like, I'm not looking at how to like try to make money off you. Like it sounds like half these other ones are, but I'm trying to say, hey man, like here's my newest thing. I'm telling people you're probably looking for distribution and guess what? The internet is your distribution. Not that you want to hear that, but that's the day and age we live in now. Like
sure.
There's no, if you go to a distribution company, they're going to be pitching your film to the very people on the internet that you could reach yourself. So it's like, there's no more reason for the distribution company at all.
I hear you, man. My distribution plan is interesting and it's unconventional. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
I have something in the works and I will be releasing more information about it soon, but it is very much my own distribution pipeline. You know,
that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I think a lot of filmmakers are coming to the realization that self-distribution
absolutely
is probably the most optimal solution.
Self-distribution to a point. Here's the problem with self-distribution when you say it this way, because here's how I'm picturing it. When you say self-distribution, are you meaning like your own website selling your stuff and blah blah blah? Yeah, sure. But here's the problem. If everyone's doing that, now you're putting a million more websites on the internet or whatever. Now each person has to be found individually as filmmakers and blah, blah, blah. So unfortunately, there still needs to be some type of Netflix that completely isn't Netflix. There needs to be some Netflix type platform that is un-internet.
Yeah. And because I think there's so many tiers of what distribution represents, I feel comfortable in, you know, grabbing onto a self-distribution window to start, to begin. Yeah. And right. if it goes well enough. And I also have a plan for doing the soundtrack first, promoting the soundtrack as a piece that, yep, you can pay a certain amount of money and pull the digital download down. Yep. And you know, I'm going to start with that. And then what I noticed today was that I have a Facebook page for the film, yep, and I invited all my friends to like it. And what I noticed today is that I think I've got like 120 that are not my friend that are that have liked it. So that right there is like a sign of
exactly
the start of some level of awareness and success on the part of, you know, getting the word out.
Exactly. No, totally. I agree with what you're saying. There needs to be sort of a dumb pipeline, if you will, like a place for someone to go to find, you know, independent, not even just have to say independent film, a place to go to find something other than Netflix, right? Or Hulu or whatever you want to kind of label that streaming stuff as, right?
Yeah.
There needs to be that place where individuals can go and upload their stuff with no sort of gatekeeper. So that way, the public can decide whether or not that person's work is worth buying / renting / whatever. And if you start to build up your audience, like you're saying, you then leverage your audience from there and you go on your own merry way. And you know what I'm saying? Then you're able to kind of build your own brand from there, you know?
Absolutely. I think independent film is a pretty wide realm of passion projects, and it's easy to believe in something you've created, but then is it something objectively that's working that somebody will sit there, not know anyone involved in the production, and genuinely consume it and like it to the degree of telling people that they saw something they really liked? I mean, that's the competitive element to me.
Exactly.
And that's creating something that really resonates, that really objectively works, you know.
And that's what this platform would allow, because like you said, everyone's got their passion projects. I mean, I'm sure every filmmaker thinks their film's the best, regardless of, you know, whatever quality it is, whatever the best they could do with it. You would hope every filmmaker thinks their film's the best. So if you have a website and like an unbiased website that's like, hey, load your film, sell it, rent, stream it, whatever, and let the audience decide what it is, like, then there's no more arguments. Like, is it compelling to be watched? Are people giving their dollar to watch it or whatever? Are they tweeting it? You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're not able even to sort of get on that platform, who's to ever say? Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We're out of that realm now where it's like, hey, the guy with the money has to decide if my story, not even if my story is good enough or whatever, if my story can make him 10 times more than he gives me to make it. That's the only thing that matters at the end of the day.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. And so now you don't need to worry about that. If you can get your film made, or you know what, you can find someone that believes in your film or believes in your project, gives you 10 grand, and now you can make it. But if you don't have the platform to put it on, why does that matter anymore? I mean, and again, it's kind of like YouTube's exists, but it's like, it's just 48 hours of video is uploaded every minute to YouTube.
Oh man, I mean, I think it might be more than that, Jonathan. I mean, I think it might be more.
So try catching up with that fire hose. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like,
absolutely. And there's an instinct, I think, for filmmakers that when they finish a project, they really want people to see it. And YouTube can be that knee jerk reaction to get something out there, and you start seeing the view count go up, and that becomes kind of the extent of your distribution. And, you know, there's not a ton of money to be made in terms of ad rev at this point.
Oh, no.
Longer on YouTube.
Well, here's what has to happen with like the platform I was saying. Like, here's kind of the problem of what happened to not even just film, but content makers in general, is the subscription service. That has what has killed content creators, because it's devalued content to such an extent where it's like, pay $20, watch whatever you want, right? Like,
this
costs nothing to make, right? I mean, do people pay $20 and go eat as much as they want everywhere they go to eat? You know what I'm saying? So it's like,
sure. No, and so, as a person who loves this stuff and seeks out the interesting films, I still want to get it on a Blu-ray. I you know, I saw that promo for Stephen Kostansky's Psycho Goreman, and I was like, yes, what is this? I want to know more. And his marketing efforts and the efforts they put into that were brilliant. You know, it totally inspired me to like own it physically, you know, and I'm a big proponent of physical media.
Exactly. And we need to change kind of the mind, you know, start to bring the mindset back to maybe that mentality where it's like, you know what, this content, it's valuable. Like, right. It's not just this, oh, I paid my $20 and I can do whatever I want with it kind of thing. Right. Cause
I want with an entire inventory of content that's going to be ever changing and programmed. And I come across these huge budget Hollywood productions on Netflix and I start watching them. I'm just like, they didn't market this to me. I don't know what this is. I mean, it looks beautiful and it's got stars and it's got, you know, all the bells and whistles, but I don't really know what I'm, you know, and then I get distracted and I don't finish it.
And so the other part of the problem is the Netflix companies, you know, and Spotify, they devalue, you know, you're getting what, 0.003% of a stream, like if you're lucky, right? So if you get 50 cents for someone to watch or stream your film, that's 5,000 times more than Spotify gives you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know, it's taken me to be about 40 years old to acknowledge this and to learn.
No, me too. I'm realizing like I'm guilty of loving Spotify because it's awesome to be like every song I ever want to hear is at like my fingertips. I'm like, this is so cool, but they're not really getting paid for it. You know what I'm saying? Like the real person that created that song that you're enjoying is really getting like ripped off, but you're getting the entertainment from it. You know,
I totally agree. I was watching something on YouTube and it was called Poppy. I don't know if you've ever heard of Poppy.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
She's so interesting. And
she is amazing.
The stuff that she has put out and the way she plays with the platform as a means of experimentation and the way she's always changing and the brand is never pinned down to one thing.
Oh, I know her music is amazing.
I find her fascinating. So that's another one where I was like, I want to seek out a physical CD. I want to own a Poppy CD. And I had to go to the UK to get it. And it took like, months for it to show up in my mailbox. But yeah, like it's stuff like that. It's if you can create a product or a brand that resonates on a level that you know inspires that desire to own something and have it in hands,
exactly,
you know, something tangible that you can touch.
Exactly,
I still think there's value to that.
No, there is for sure. And I think you know, but obviously, kids, you know, that have grown up kind of with this digital age where they either I don't really know what they think of the analog age where people like say where people had record albums, right, or people had their DVD collection, you know, like what. I don't know what they would necessarily think of that. They'd be like, oh, it's a waste of space or who cares? Like I watch whatever I want, whenever I want to figure my tips. Like, I don't think that, like you're saying, I don't think they understand to that extent what you were just describing.
Yeah,
that
it's
ownership,
sad.
That
it's,
ownership part.
I really am raising my kids differently because I know they're seeing me interact with all this media. I mean, I've got a lot. I've got a Laserdisc collection. I've got a ton of VHS. I love the DVD Blu-rays, you know, so I've held on to it. I never felt with CDs, music, that kind of collapsed because of. I couldn't keep up with music, unfortunately. But film, I've really tried to protect it. You know, I've really tried to.
Laserdisc. Oh, man.
Yeah, Laserdisc is wild. One of the reasons why I love Laserdisc is because, A, it represents an era that is very much pre-internet. So if you just search the word Laserdisc on eBay, every title that shows up is something from that era that is before the digital kind of takeover.
Exactly.
If you're feeling burned out on web culture, search the word Laserdisc and it'll like immediately take you back to this this time before.
Man, I can remember going to a yard sale with my mom at like, you know, in like 1986, and we bought a Laserdisc player. It came with like, the Summer Rental, Amadeus, Breakfast Club. I had the Laserdisc player, dude. It was awesome.
Yeah, they're cool. And there's a lot of films that actually did not make it to DVD, and Laserdisc remains the best format for a number of obscure yet very entertaining titles.
That is funny. No kidding.
Yeah, there's a ton of them. There's way more than I thought. And I keep discovering new ones.
Man, that is so cool. So then do how big's like your DVD Blu-ray collection? Like you said you're protecting that. Do you have like a pretty big collection?
Yeah, you know those Billy bookcases? You know,
oh yeah, yeah.
I want to say like 7 feet high. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 like rows deep.
Man.
I have two of them, and they go one on one side of my television and one on the other.
Oh my goodness.
And I've got thousands.
Is it all one genre, or do you have like all types of movies?
I've got all kinds of movies. I'm a big cinephile, yeah. So it's everything that's cool. You can imagine. But franchises I've condensed into, you know, I love the 6-disc carriers that are
okay
condensed into like a normal looking DVD, but inside there's 6 discs.
Oh yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
That way you can kind of overlap inserts and you can have all the Predator films, you know, in one collection. So that's the way I've been able to manage it, but it is a challenge. It is. And I have to part with things sometimes. And in Hollywood here, there's a company called Amoeba, and you can bring physical media to Amoeba and they will either give you money or store credit for it. And
that's cool.
Yeah, that still exists.
So they must have a version of this, if you will. If they walk in there, and they must be like, "Oh dear Lord, like how much money do I have in my account?" You know, like.
Yeah, well, they're also really smart about what has value and what is a dime a dozen. So if you bring stuff to them, and I'll bring them rare stuff because I am a big consumer of all this kind of media, and Vinegar Syndrome and. A number of these other companies, Severin, they've been putting out so many obscure titles and doing these 4K and HD transfers.
Wait, time out a minute. I might be a step behind this conversation. Are you saying they are still putting out new LaserDisc?
No, not LaserDiscs.
Okay.
There is a VHS company that is actually does that for the sole purpose of nostalgia. They will.
Well, the only reason why I asked that is because I interviewed this guy that was legit. There's people that make new Atari games. They take the cartridges out and they reprogram them and they make new Atari games. It's ridiculous.
That's cool.
So that's why I was like, wait a minute, dude, are you saying people, you know, that's why. sorry to interrupt you that way, but that's why I was like, that's gonna be sick if that's what he's saying.
No, but I mean, it is exciting that there are still companies that are digging up these old obscure films.
No, totally.
Proper HD transfers, because in the analog era we were not seeing them in their proper form.
No.
So, I mean, and audio too. I mean, it gets cleaned up so well to the point where you're really experiencing the director's intention for the first time when you're seeing them in this capacity. So that is an element of the modern era that I very much appreciate.
So what did you must have done something before Billy Kills the Internet. What other kinds of things have you done?
Well, I got into this business. I went to film school 2000 through 2004 over at Columbia College in Chicago.
Nice.
And I got a degree in directing and minor in editing. And right off the bat, I started working for General Motors over in Detroit.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, I was doing like training films, and safety videos and stuff like that. And I had friends that I had collaborated creatively with, you know, when we were kids. And they were trying to get a horror movie off the ground. And that sounded nice. Cool to me. So nice. There was a Detroit effort to do this movie called The Tower. And so this is back in like 2008. That it finally got distributed. But The Tower is a really cool experimental kind of art house film that I was able to have a big creative input on. I did all the music, I edited the film, my wife is the lead.
Oh, that's cool.
I did a bunch of I performance in it. I did makeup, you know, I did a character that had his eyes blind, and I had these
nice
contacts put in to give you the white eye, you know.
Glue. Yeah, look, exactly.
Yeah. So I did this really weird, cool movie, and then we got it into the AFM in like 2009. That's when I moved out to LA. It got distributed.
Dude, your first film got into AFM?
Well, it wasn't my film per se. I definitely was a big part of the production, but it did. Yeah, it was at AFM.
That's no joke. Okay.
A company, a sales rep that we got in touch with. Had it, and then we got it distributed in Japan. Man. So that was kind of the full scope of what we accomplished with that. And I was then now I was living in Los Angeles and jumping around as a production assistant on big movies. So I was finally learning like how the big movies get made, which was really fascinating. I kind of cut my teeth on Fast and the Furious.
Oh man.
And like second unit stuff. So I was all the car stuff.
Speaking of second unit, I'm going to put this out there. Danny, of course, I can't remember his last name. He played on second unit. He was one of the trolls. Danny, it's terrible.
From Fast and Furious or another?
No. From Special Unit 2, that show Special Unit 2.
Oh, okay.
Danny, his real name's Danny. He played a troll in second unit, Special Unit 2.
Okay. I'm talking about second unit.
Never mind.
Oh, that's okay. No. Second unit is the team that comes in and does a lot of the harder kind of like practical work that makes up some of these special effects shots in these movies.
Cool.
You watch a film like Fast and the Furious, first unit is going to be the talent, right? All the stars and their drama and those moments and some of the action stuff, but the real blatant like cars flipping through the air and explosions and all that stuff, that's done by a different team altogether, and that's second unit.
That's cool, dude.
And it was kind of like a military form of what I would call art school, you know.
I believe it, man.
Yeah, like, it was,
you must have
intense.
Worked with some monster computers and like some serious software.
Oh yeah, so in the post end, it's a whole nother beast, and I started to get more involved with digital. I worked for a company called Machinima for about 5 years.
Okay.
And Machinima was doing a lot of digital, and that's where I kind of jumped from what was happening in the traditional realm of Hollywood to then what was happening on the digital front with YouTube and multi-channel networks and all that stuff. And while I was there, I continued to try and make independent films, and I made one called Attack of the Devil.
Nice.
And Attack of the Devil was my first, you know, comprehensive, like try to do a lot of things, try to have a big idea. You would probably appreciate that one as well.
Absolutely.
It's kind of like a combination of giant monster kaiju stuff.
Nice.
With a musical element. There's a literal like musical numbers in the film.
What's the state of that film? Has
it been Attack of the Devil is just on YouTube. You know, that was just distributed digitally on YouTube, and I let people just have it. It's also got a really strong theme that I believe in about circumcision.
How old is that film?
Attack of the Devil is 2014, I believe.
Okay. I was gonna say, man, I'm gonna submit it into the festival, but I'm still gonna watch it though, because it sounds amazing. Just because I know what I'm capable of doing, so I have to see that now. That's what I'm saying.
Yes. Yeah. If you like Billy Kills the Internet, you'll probably like Attack of the Devil.
Okay. Perfect. Perfect. Yeah, dude. I mean, you are. I love how creative you are, because, like I said, we grew up. We saw analog turn into digital, and you really messed with that on Billy Kills the Internet. Like it's
absolutely
so cool.
I love having a reference for all of these things. And another element of Billy Kills the Internet is ventriloquism. And ventriloquism goes way back, and it's fascinating. When you kind of look into the history of that particular art form, those puppets have a certain quality, a certain kind of antique creepiness.
They
kind of have a power about them. So I started to really kind of collect those dolls, those ventriloquist dolls. And I made two custom ones in Billy Kills. There's Vishnu.
You made that one?
Yeah, that's entirely fabricated by myself.
No kidding.
Yeah.
When I tell my friend, he's going to be blown away though by that. He was laughing so hard at that one. He was like, I can't even tell you what it looks like. He's like, he was laughing so hard. He was just like, he did the best he could. And trust me, I'm sure he did a good job, but he's going to be blown away when he knows you made it though.
Well, Vishnu is like one of the gods, you know, Indian.
No, but he just loved how you did it though.
Thank you so much. I was really proud of the paint that I found that was able to get the blue skin tone smooth on.
Yeah,
There's two other creatures that are kind of like ventriloquist dummies that show up in the film that I made. One of them is a big monster that they encounter in the Dark Realm, and another is the final boss. Which is also a ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah. He's not gonna believe you made those. Maybe I'm glad we're recording this.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's like another route. Like, being a filmmaker is wearing a lot of hats. And,
it is.
I've definitely done a lot of different aspects of the business, and one of them is fabrication and prop building, and it's a whole other realm of like where you use all the assets that you can to create a very unique item that is needed for the film. And my wife works in props.
That's awesome, dude.
She got a job.
I was gonna say, like, again, we're kind of from, you know, not kind of, but we're in that generation where you, as a filmmaker, as a creator, you're kind of like, all right, I need, you know, this doll, for lack of a better term, whatever, to look like this. One doesn't exist. Okay, like, what do I need to make a doll? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you don't let it stop you. You still execute the idea. You get it done. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, that's what being an artist is.
And that's what I'm hoping people listening get, where it's like, look, you know, there's a hurdle. The character doesn't exist. You need make it, you know, like that. That's right. Part of being a creator, right?
Like, yeah. And a lot of it is like spending the money that you need to spend to accomplish the thing that you're, you know, as a filmmaker and a movie connoisseur or whatever, a cinephile.
Sure.
That's kind of what I spend my money on. I'm not a gamer. If I did a lot of video games, I cut my teeth on the NES and the Super NES.
Dude, me too. Those are my jams. There you go.
Yeah. PlayStation came out. PlayStation was pretty cool, but like, I started to kind of drift away from it because I could feel just how enticing it is to put your time into those things. And as awesome as they are, and my God, the modern stuff is unbelievable.
And those things are cinematic all on their own.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I mean, they are pulling off incredible feats of technology and storytelling with video games.
Oh, yeah.
It is a very, very cool aspect of this industry. I definitely learned a ton about it when I was at Machinima, because that was the bread and butter, really, of what they were doing over there. You know, content that
I believe that. Yeah. You
know, created by gamers, about gamers.
Exactly.
It's a whole nother realm of this industry. But
totally.
If I got sucked into that, I would just have no time left to do anything else.
well, which is why none of our kids do.
right. And it's sad. Like, I really have to put my foot down to make sure that the kids are experiencing more to life than just what those games are so brilliantly designed to do, which is really just to suck them in and keep them playing. And it's a little bit evil what they're able to do to these kids.
Well, yeah, it's evil slash, I don't want to say impressive. It is evil, you know, and that's why we need the reminder now of kind of saying like, hey, yeah, this stuff is cool, right? Guess what? Someone created it. And you know what? That someone could be you. So controller down, you know, put the controller down, turn up the TV, put the tablet down or whatever. And, you know, and start creating something, pick up a pad and pen, start whatever it is. I mean, unfortunately, I can't say turn up the computer because you're probably going to have to use it to create something. But the idea behind it is to stop consuming and start creating.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was at Machinima, one of the other things that I did that kind of made a mark on some people was a show called Mario Plush Forever. It's definitely a YouTube program that had a cult audience behind it. And what we did was we used Mario plush toys, those little stuffed animals. And what I was finding was on YouTube, the kids were using their video cameras and their phones to kind of record their play with these toys, and they were getting a lot of views. And I thought, well, you know, as a 30-some-year-old, I could probably swoop into this subgenre and do.
As a 30-year-old, I could totally outscript an 8-year-old.
Exactly. So that's another one that I did that's very bizarre and very kind of, it's kind of controversial.
I gotta check that out now. What was it? Mario what?
It's called Mario Plush Forever.
Okay, I gotta check that out. Mario.
Yeah, Bros. And people Forever. Still to this day will send me messages and make comments on the video about how it changed them as kids, or that, you know, it was their childhood or whatever. But
dude, that is cool.
It was cool. It's tonally very weird. It's kiddie, but then it becomes very adult in places.
Mm. So
it was a kind of an experimentation of what you can do on a platform like YouTube, and kind of harkening back to what we were talking about before the podcast started, you know, the idea that anyone can get on YouTube and program content for children that does not abide by any kind of, you know, standard of
what
is kids content and what is an adult content.
Right.
So it's really an experimentation with what is, you know, kiddie, but then all of a sudden very graphic and very violent. And stuff like that. So that's Mario Plush Forever, and it was a lot of fun to make, and definitely sent me down many strange rabbit holes as a content creator.
That is so cool, though. But that's another good point too. Like, even thinking about like using plushies and stuff, or like, again, YouTube is such an interesting. It's still such an interesting platform, even though it feels like it's been around forever now. But I've never considered like. Yeah, what if I had like the whole kind of Nintendo plushie set I could act out? Like, that's just, you know, again, it just another interesting concept someone could be doing, creating. Like, it's just, there's nothing out there to stop anyone anymore.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was really about figuring out how to do the green screen and light it correctly and be able to separate the assets well enough, you know, to be able to change the backgrounds and put your characters in whatever environment you need to put
them
in. And if you can kind of crack that code, which can be challenging, you got to light things a certain way and you got to have the space
to work with and stuff. Yeah.
But it's not that hard. And if you can kind of figure that part out, there's the sky is the limit, man. You can
kind of
write anything and bring anything to life in that capacity. Totally.
Now, is there anything you're working on right now, Lon, that currently do you need any help with anything? Do you have a website for everyone to go to and check out?
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah, well, I've got a company called Strickland Media. So it's strickland.media. If you just put that in your browser, that should pop up. And it's a website that is selling my various different skills in post-production. So it's editing, special effects, music, sound design.
Awesome.
And a little bit of prop fabrication. Terms of what I'm doing professionally, I've been working on a lot of like documentary productions. Sourcing content for a series of films called In Search of Darkness,
can you tell people that's about it?
In Search of Darkness is an epic documentary series about 80s cinema.
Man,
it's really, really cool. It's
I want to see that the second it comes out.
Oh, it's so good. And it's out. You can actually, you can get copies through Creator VC, I believe. You have to kind of become a member of, it's very much what we were talking about in terms of like self-distribution and it's a crowdfunding effort.
Okay.
And to appease what the people throwing the money at it wanted, they were totally down for 4 hours.
So
we're talking about like mammoth sized documentaries that are really well done. The director, David Weiner, is from Entertainment Tonight resume. He has all the Rolodex of like every creator and actor that was involved in these productions. And he's a great interviewer, and he'll sit down with these amazing icons of the genre and get these incredible documentary interviews. And they're all really well put together. It's done by primarily a team out of England. And I got my first experience with documentary through those films. And that led me to another project that I'm currently working on. And I'm in the kind of like close to signing on it deal. Okay. So I can't be specific about what it is.
Yeah.
It is one of the major staples of the horror genre, and it's going to be an expansive documentary all about it.
Wow. Okay. That's very exciting. Also then, that's cool. Okay. No, that's really cool. So it was strickland.media, and there'll be links in the show notes and everything. Lon, this was definitely the longest interview, and I have no problem with that, because like there wasn't even like a moment of silence, man. Like, I'm telling you, Billy Kills the Internet is awesome. I'm a huge fan of your style for sure, dude. Like, you know, I can't wait to check out the other ones that you mentioned and everything. And it's been an honor and pleasure to meet you. And I cannot wait to be able to show Billy Kills the Internet. Is there anything else you wanted to mention? Any last words for the audience? Anything else you want to throw out there for anyone?
Well, yeah, I mean, find it on social media, you know, before it's too late, because the internet's going down.
Exactly. Seriously, Billy will kill the internet, though. But Lon, again, thanks for your time, man. It's greatly appreciated. And thank you so much for the submission. Everyone, thank you for listening and downloading. Don't forget August 27th, Foxwoods Casino. You'll be able to see Billy Kills the Internet there also with many other people. And we'll be more on that soon, August 27th. Don't forget, embrace your storm. See ya.
Tornado with Jonathan Nadeau. If you haven't yet, please subscribe now so you're first to hear new episodes with more stories of inspiration about the highs and lows of life and how embracing the storm is so much more fulfilling of a life than being crushed by the weight of the world. And until then, we hope you're inspired to do something, whether it's creating, participating, or learning, whatever leads you to your personal passion.